It is invariably the sufferers who bring first notification of it to the scientific community. Most recently, we certainly know that about the epidemic of AIDS and HIV and other health issues. Since 1998, the National Unidentified Skin Parasite Association, known as NUSPA, has helped otherwise desperate sufferers by providing them with an internet discussion board where people meet, share observations, come for support, and work together to get help. These are folks who are coming together who have sometimes what they describe as tormenting skin sensations and excoriations that their medical practitioners or physicians otherwise attribute to, and I quote, imaginary illness. One person who shares her story was begging her health officials in the state where she lived to help her get rid of the parasites that she knew were overtaking her home and burrowing beneath her skin. This health official gave her the number of a good psychiatrist. The stories are many. I will let Deborah Altshuler, who has been a very significant voice in support of many thousands of people who have contacted her through the National Pediculosis Association's development of a registry, talk about what this issue is. And I welcome her yet again to WBAI and to Health Styles. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Barbara. Good to be here.
Deborah, I think it's a good place to start how you became, in addition, we know that I've had the privilege of bringing the information about head lice to WBAI listener community over the last, I almost think, 10 years now. And you and I have been in dialogue offline, off radio, about this other emerging issue. Can you talk a little bit about the history on how you became involved in the effort of gathering information and supporting this community?
Well, the National Pediculosis Association is a very focused, small nonprofit that pretty much does what nobody else wants to do. We deal with head lice and helping parents who are panic-stricken about it, and most importantly, helping them to avoid making potentially harmful responses with certain chemicals or pesticides. So by doing what nobody else wants to do, we're also privileged, and I put that in quotes, to be on the receiving end of information that nobody else is going to get because they're not asking the same kinds of questions that we are. But in the mid-90s, we opened up a bona fide national reporting registry, the first of its kind in the world, where people who had lice or scabies could actually report an outbreak or report that their product didn't work or that their product may have hurt them badly. And in the process of doing this, we inadvertently opened up the floodgates for another population of individuals who initially thought they had lice or scabies, but in reality had a totally different problem. And so the lines of communication probably play as big a role in this as the apparently increasing incidence of this, where people initially treat themselves as though they have lice or scabies, or their physicians treat them that way, but there is no resolution of their symptoms, which are, as you had said earlier, horrific. The sensation, or the reality, let's put it that way, of bugs crawling under their skin, being bitten by bugs, not seeing these bugs, and having the people that they rely upon for support pretty much dismissing it as an imaginary illness. Even if it were an imaginary illness, which we have good reason to believe it's not, the lack of support added on top of the suffering makes it a horrific situation, and I'm happy to be here to be a voice for these people who don't seem to have a voice in getting the quality of help that they need.
The registry has been a support for a gathering of a lot of this information, and I note on your on the research that I've read from listed in, on your website that you then attempted to see what in fact was out there around what this could possibly be. And can you speak a little bit to that?
Well, we pretty much have been treated the way the sufferers have been treated. We've been bounced off of walls, as it were, looking for someone to give us assistance in getting to the bottom of this. And in the process, we more or less just kept doing the work. And in doing the work, we were able to get a basis and some common denominators in terms of what was consistent among this population. And this population also had consistent among them the experience of going to multitudes of doctors, sometimes 10, 15 physicians. It's a lot of money, a lot of time out of work, and still coming back with the same diagnosis of having an imaginary illness.
we have an opportunity to speak to someone, and the question that I wanted to pose perhaps would be best posed to a gentleman whose name is David, and we will refer to him by his first name only for the program, to share a little bit, if you will, David, what the course of your own path has been in order to, after first experiencing these symptoms, and how many different evaluations, consultations, and regimens of therapeutic care you've gone through to this point in having had this type of health problem, if you would. And welcome to Health Styles.
Yes, and thank you for doing this program. Could you please repeat that question?
Tell us about your own story and what's happened in your course of identifying this problem, and when did it start, and what's it like, and how many different doctors have you been to, or types of therapies have you attempted to treat this?
Well, my illness started in July of 2003. And initially, I was told by my doctor that it was probably black flies, mosquitoes, or another small fly that we have around here called no-see-um. So I treated myself with insect repellents. And he said it would go away eventually once the cold weather arrived. Well, when it didn't go away by the end of September, then I was diagnosed with scabies, so I tried the scabies medicine, which is Quilada or Lindane. Hmm. Tried them both, actually. And the Lindane worked the first time, but after about a week or 10 days, it came back, and the Lindane didn't work anymore. The Quilada didn't seem to work at all. So then I asked to be referred to a dermatologist, which they did. And I went and saw the dermatologist, and he didn't get up from his seat behind his desk. He didn't even give me time to roll up my sleeve or show him any of my lesions. He said he knew exactly what I had, what parasite I had, and he knew what medicine to give me, so I was thrilled. So I took the prescription to my pharmacist, and she looked at it, and she started laughing. So I said, what's funny? What's so funny? She says, you don't need this. And I said, well, the dermatologist says I do. It's supposed to be for a parasite. She says, this is not for a parasite. This is for Tourette syndrome. It was called ORAP. So I took my prescription back out, went to see my family doctor again. And I said, what's the big idea? Well, he said, the dermatologist feels you have called it up here a psychoneural dermatitis. And you call it down there delusions of parasitosis. I'm in Canada. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell you that. So I said, well, I'll try the medicine. He convinced me to try the medicine. So I tried it for about 5 days, and I actually became psychotic. So I stopped taking it, and I went back and told him. I said, I want to see another dermatologist. So he referred me to another one, and it took about 3 months to get to see the guy. He was the only other one actually within driving distance of where I live. I walked in. The same thing happened. He didn't come near me. He sat behind his desk and said, you got psychoneural dermatitis, and the only medicine that there is for it is antipsychotic medicines. So I said I didn't believe him, and I asked him at that. By now, I knew that the first protocol that they're supposed to follow as dermatologists is to do a skin scraping. I didn't know that before with the first dermy. So I asked him if he would do a skin scraping. He said, "What's that?" I said, I don't know what it is, but you're supposed to be able to do it if you're a dermatologist. Oh, he said, I don't know anything about it. I said, you're supposed to have a microscope here, too. He said, well, I don't have one. so I said, well, fine then. You know, I said, I'm leaving. I'm not taking your antipsychotic medicines. You guys aren't doing your job. And that was about it as far as seeing doctors. I still continue to see my family doctor until the next summer was the summer of 04. Sorry, the summer of 03. And I saw a Lyme specialist. And he put me on antibiotics, and it helped a bit. But eventually we got to the point with the antibiotics that he couldn't bump them up anymore. Because I was third generation, and he said he wasn't allowed to go any higher than that without permission from an organization who've got the audacity to call themselves the CDC here in the province where I live. Can you imagine?
David, at this stage, what can you describe what your lesions were like and how this impacted your day-to-day living?
Well, they started out just like seeming like mosquito bites with a little bump, except they were extremely itchy. But then after about 6 months, they'd gotten to the point where they were circular lesions about half to three-quarters of an inch around, and some of them were a quarter to three-eighths of an inch deep. When trying to wash them, lumps of things would come out of them, you know, that didn't look like it was anything human to me, but I couldn't see anything under a microscope that I could identify.
You started to look yourself under the microscope at this point?
Yeah.
Are you?
I actually thought at that point that I had something that's called Norwegian scabies, which is also called crusted scabies, where the person gets scabies and the skin thickens,
uh-huh.
And the scabies live in the thousands or millions under the skin. It's a disease that has one of the highest suicide rates in the world, and I mm-hmm. think I can understand why.
You've done a lot of research on your own, haven't you?
I did some for the first year, but after the first year I gave up, and my daughter took it up, and she continued from it because I had basically given up.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so after the finished the treatment by the Lyme doctor, and it still didn't clear it up. And I had told him a few times, I think I got a parasite. And he said, well, even, you know, whatever you got, you need antibiotics just by the look of your skin. So I'd pretty well given up, actually, but in August of 04, my daughter found the report by the NPA. So I signed up on their list registry. And then a couple of months later, I think everybody that was on the registry got a note saying that, I forget what the note was, but I responded to it. And I said, thanks very much, because at least somebody's paying attention to this. And then that began, sort of a rapport with Deborah about what it was about. And it went from there, and she's been monitoring. She suggested I see a naturopath and get scrapings done by a naturopath because they're more open-minded. So I did, and the scrapings were looked at by the NPA, and I was told that they were consistent with the Oklahoma study.
David, we'll come back to you in a moment, and thank you for thank you for sharing a very difficult path and having the courage to step forth with this information for our benefit today, and we'll come back to you in just a moment. Deb, will you pick up with David mentioning the Oklahoma study and talk a little bit about that, unless there's something you need to say before you do that?
Well, David is typical of so many of these people who have contacted us, and you know, when you've done head lice, as it were, for so many years, you get really comfortable with doing something that's not so glamorous. But the philosophy at the NPA has always been the most important disease is the one you have, and the expert is the person who has it. And we learned so much by listening to people like David, who, by the way, I'm not sure whether or not he mentioned, but the onset of his symptoms began after swimming in a local pond, or a lake, I'm not sure which it was, but that was that seemed to be the a factor that changed his life. And that's so common among the people who reported to us. The onset of their symptoms began when their basement flooded, or if they had had some sort of a landscape problem, or they had moved into a home that used to be an agricultural field or a dairy farm. And there just were common denominators that seemed part of nature that we started hearing consistently. And finally, and thankfully, and I say he is a hero, and I mean that by every stretch of the imagination, the physician who heads up the Oklahoma Department of Health, his name is Michael Crutcher. He's an MD and has a master's in public health, was also getting the same kinds of calls, and he was not dismissing them. And there's no way to ever express how important it was for him to have facilitated a clinical study under the auspices of the Department of Health in Oklahoma, where we brought a cross-section of the people who were reporting to us on a voluntary basis to Oklahoma, where in a clinical setting, with his observation as a physician and two other doctors, scrapings were taken, they were photographed under the microscope, and the digital images were forwarded along to the NPA and our consultants for us to do the work. And the work was tedious because none of us really had a preconceived notion of what we were going to find. And lo and behold, after 6 or 7 months, we were able to break the code and find the Calambula, which is a minute organism. It's the most common arthropod on the planet, very inconspicuously hidden within the skin, almost looking like the skin, and there began the rest of the story. So by having figured out how to really read the images, which required incredible time and skill to be developed, we were able to find 18 of the 20 participants in the study showing evidence of them. And we have had the study published in a very respectable journal, actually, one out of New York City, where we worked with the American Museum of Natural History and the entomologists there. Interestingly enough, when the image work was shown to the entomologists there, they were unanimously consistent, and there was great consensus that, of course, these were Calambula. But when word got out that they were Calambula being found in people's skin, then everybody started thinking, how can this be? Because they say that's impossible. Of course, at the NPA, when we hear that's impossible, that's a red flag. We say, well,
Deborah, can you explain why they say that's impossible?
Well, this little organism, which if you look at it straight in the face, if it's so ubiquitous, if it's so common to every facet of our life, everywhere there's dirt, they are there, then it's almost suspect to think that no one's ever looked at them in humans before, frankly. But when they have been found in humans, and they have been found over the past couple of centuries, they've been dismissed as an accidental occurrence. There's never really been an orchestrated effort to look at them in a clinical way as we did in Oklahoma. And I'm not saying that Oklahoma, the Oklahoma work was the be-all and end-all, but what I'm saying is it's a great beginning. There's a lot of information there that comes from what we did as basic fundamental research. And throwing away the information that came from that work is a foolish thing to do, and this is why we're here talking to you today, is it's a building block that we feel brings great credibility to the plight of these individuals, and hopefully will encourage others to take notice. If they've blown this off thinking it's not real, maybe they will reconsider it, because this is communicable. We have no doubt that this is communicable. So the longer we wait, the more foolish we will be, because once you've acquired it, we have absolutely no way of knowing how to end it.
Let's stay with this concern about Calambula being ubiquitous and now being what's from the skin scrapings identifiable as being what's creating the lesions, the serious quality of life issues for the people who have, at least in this first study, and I know that you're making tremendous efforts to have these studies replicated at different institutions and through government agencies, which we'll talk about in a minute. What is it, if you have and I know these are hypotheses that we're discussing here, and is that correct? Would you suggest that some of this is hypothesis?
Some of this is. Some of this is factual.
Okay. Why the big concern that if, in fact, this is what is emerging, what's the big concern and why all the doors being shut?
There's a bias that's entrenched among the dermatology community and probably the infectious disease community. It's sort of self-perpetuating. Nobody really wants to see these patients. They find them to be terribly demanding and frustrating, very focused, as one would be. I mean, how are they supposed to be? They're desperately looking for validation. I think many of them would prefer to have the validation even before the cure because they've been alienated from their families, their loved ones. They've lost their jobs. They've lost their income, all because it's been assigned to a psychiatric etiology. And let's just say, for the sake of discussion, it is a psychiatric etiology. Then we have an emerging public health problem with a psychiatric basis. I don't think that's the situation, although there's no doubt that once you are affected by this and so terribly abused by the people you trust to help you, you get to be terribly depressed, no question about it. But there are some that think that you must have had a predisposition. I don't know about that, because when you look at the data of the people who reported to us at the time of onset, the vast majority of them said that their health was very good, actually, or even excellent. Nobody came to us and said that they had Lyme disease and then later developed these symptoms. There was never any mention of Lyme disease or any other kind of bacterial problem. These people were healthy, but there was a particular event that somehow put them in the wrong place at the wrong time where they were able to acquire this. And there isn't one particular way to get it. I mean, we've talked to people who, like I say, built their new home on a former dairy farm, and they were working in the yard where the cows had left their dung. And these particular organisms, known as Calambula or springtail, are in nature there to break things down. That's where they hang out. So there's something that's signaling them, that's calling them up. And when they get called up, they don't get called up, here's a bug or there's a bug that you can pin to a piece of paper. They get called up by the thousands. And once they become established, it's very difficult to stop them in their paths, because they're mandated by Mother Nature, who's quite a woman, to break things down. And that's what's happening to people's skin. It's getting broken down by them.
And why is it difficult to see them in the scrapings? You mentioned that after 6 months of a very focused review of the computer digital slides, that it began to become evident that they were there in clusters and individually. Why is this not something that can be taught and is not being taught, and how come there's that resistance?
Well, that's a great question, Barbara, because we learned after the fact that scraping is scraping. So when the scalpel was used to scrape the skin, we were actually breaking apart the evidence as we did it. Since that time, we've actually made tremendous progress in using digital imaging to get a better handle on what's on the skin or in the skin. It's phenomenal what you can see, but not so phenomenal when you think about how MRIs and PET scans and CAT scans have revolutionized diagnostic medicine. Unfortunately, it hasn't revolutionized the mindset of the entomology people, because they're still wanting to pin a bug to a piece of paper. And while there's a great value to doing that, they've been missing this for over a century, and there's nothing wrong with looking at things from a different perspective. So while the skin scraping is something that enabled us to get from A to B, I think we have all kinds of different technology now that would allow us to do an even better, more definitive job without the subjective requirement of having the skill to look at the image. But you have to start somewhere. And that's another part of publishing a paper on a trailblazing kind of a subject is, you know, the first they want to do is annihilate you, and people who want your job want to discredit you and all of that. But again, you know, we can deal with that. But what we want to happen is for it to be built upon, and we're making progress with people in high places, as it were, to do that. But it's taking way too long for people like David, who've already been suffering for 3 years and have lost everything. So we thank you, Barbara. I know we're not at the end of the discussion, but I can't thank you enough for giving these people a voice through David and myself today.
You are most welcome. I'm Barbara Glickstein, and you're tuned into Health Styles on WBAI 99.5 FM. We're talking about an emerging health crisis and a discussion that you will hear first here on WBAI on Health Styles. We'll be back in just a moment. There's plenty more to talk about. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Barbara Glickstein, and you're tuned into WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. You're listening to Health Styles, which is brought to you by the Nursing and Health Resource Network in cooperation with the New York County Registered Nurses Association. Today's guest, Deborah Altshuler, founder and president of the National Pediculosis Association. And joining us as well by telephone is David from Canada, who has been most generous and kind to be part of this conversation today, discussing a health situation, a health condition without a name, perhaps, without a direction, and with a tremendous amount of need for more research and attention to be given to it, which is why we are devoting today's program of Health Styles to look at this question of the etiology of a parasitic disease, if you will, that has been cornered for the most part into a psychiatric disorder. As a nurse, I am moved that people, particularly people who come in with an unsightly and difficult health problem, and particularly a skin disorder, I must tell you, there is something about a person coming close to you and coming into your room, I think we can all admit to this, who is covered with open lesions. We're concerned about what it is. Can I catch it? Is it infected? Who is this person? And as much of our empathy and compassion is needed, walls do go up.
I'd like to add to that that it's an interesting thing we tell people when they call. If you go to see the physician and they're not taking precautions, gloving up, gowning up, making sure that the next person that comes into the examining room isn't going to be exposed, then don't waste your time. They don't believe you. Don't waste your time. Don't waste their time. There's no question that this should requires strict precautions to be taken. And the fact that David is here from Canada doesn't take away the reality that we have reports from New York City, West Side, East Side, all over the state. We have reports from every state in America. And the data is on its own pretty compelling. So we want to be sure that people don't have the misconception that this isn't going to happen in their neck of the woods. They would be amazed where these reports come from.
Deborah, let's talk about springtails a little bit in Columbula. What do they look like? And we know that they're microscopic in size, so it's not something someone can see on their skin. But how do they look, and how, in fact, do they impact, and how do they live?
Well, I'm not a springtail expert, nor had I ever heard of them before this, so I don't want to mislead anyone to think that I am, but I can tell you that initially, they could very easily be mistaken for lice. And in nature, you could see them on the back of leaves. In the wintertime, you can see them bouncing on the snow in great numbers. They're also called snow fleas. And they can be so minute that it requires a microscope, but they can be big enough to see. And once you develop the skill of identifying them, you can see them on the skin. You can see them clustered around the lesion, actually. But it does look very much like what you would expect to see around a lesion because they've probably been doing this for some time without being recognized. I think they've been inconspicuous since the beginning of time as far as people goes, if we're now finding them the way we're finding them in people's skin. The first report of anyone having this quote-unquote supposed delusional illness was from the 1800s in the literature. But you can go back to images from mental institutions and see people who were locked up because they were accused of neurotic picking. And the Columbula feed on fungus primarily, but they are there as the decomposers. Interestingly enough, the morticians say that when it comes to who shows up first on a corpse, springtail are there first. That's very suspicious also. So it's not as though they don't have some sort of a distinguished tradition of being accounted for here and there. It's just that there never really was a collective effort to pull it all together. And I'm proud that the NPA, being the little guys that we are, we were able to do this and to get the ball rolling because we are very small. But small is not bad because small can be very focused, and that's why when someone calls, we hear them, and we don't assume that they're mental, and we don't presume that we know more than they do. So people, if I would say anything to any of the physicians, listen to these people. They are incredible wealth of information. And don't assume that you know more about this than they do. They're living it. And please, please, try to help. I mean, there's so much technology today. This is basic stuff.
One of the concerns that comes up in thinking about this and the ubiquity of them and the fact that they are parasites is there another role that they potentially can be playing in carrying other disease or other health issues, if they live on and are engaged in this sort of ecosystem with fungi and bacteria, and there's a question of balance and imbalance, what is the potentiality of them being involved in other public health epidemiology?
Well, they are a major player in the cycle of life, in the carbon cycle. Without them, we would not be here. They make it possible for the soil to be fertile enough for plants to grow and photosynthesis and air for us to breathe and all of that. But at the same time, if you look at it ecologically or environmentally, we've displaced many of the organisms by trying to kill everything. And by doing that, you have annihilated a lot of the predators for organisms like springtail or calambula, which means that if they're not defending themselves, they're just making more of themselves. So yes, the balance of nature gets tipped, and when it gets tipped at the most basic level of how we breathe and live and eat, then it trickles up and down and all over the place to where it's almost impossible to reel it back in. They are incredibly important in our lives on this planet.
David, you mentioned a couple of things I'd like to go back to if we can. Your research on your own and your desire to find answers also has led members of your family. You mentioned your daughter, who actually helped you connect with the NPA and with Deb Altshuler. What has this been like for you on a day-to-day basis in terms of family, community, your work? How has this impacted your life?
Well, I had a good job, but I had to leave it.
And what kind of work did you do, David?
I was in the telecommunications business.
Mm-hmm.
And, the lesions were bothering people around me, so they didn't ask me to leave, but they didn't ask me to stay when I said I thought I should leave. Mm. So I left. And I took a job working outside where I thought people wouldn't mind so much, working in construction. But it bothered people there. So then I just stayed off work for about 6 months and trying to spend more time trying to find out what this was. And now I'm starting to, I've gotten my lesions down to a quite minimal number because of the help of a naturopath and the help of the NPA.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how you've been working with the naturopath? And I know this is specific to you, and if anyone who is listening has reason to believe that they are suffering from the same problem, I would urge you to contact the NPA and register, and know that the sharing of this information, if David is willing to share this information, is something specific to his particular needs, and I would urge you to take that into consideration if David would share that with us.
Well, I just happened to luck onto a good naturopath, because I guess there are some that are not so good and some that are good, just like any other profession. And she believed me right away that I had a parasite. She'd never heard of calambula, at least not as a parasite. But she was willing to do the scrapings and take the pictures and send them to the NPA to be looked at, and then they sent them back showing the calambula circled on the pictures. So then she began to treat. She said, "Well, you've got something." She's not an expert on calambula either, but you got something in there that's some kind of a parasite. So we've got to get rid of it. And she'd already decided ahead of time that the way to do it was not to try and kill it. The way to do it was to try and make it uncomfortable on my body by working on other things like pH balance and getting rid of any fungal infections I might have or anything else like that using naturopathic medicine. And also with a little bit with diet, about what not to eat and what to eat. And forcing me to drink 10 glasses of water a day.
Was that hard to do?
Well, it was hard, yeah, because at that point I was working driving a cab.
Hmm.
It was kind of
not many places to stop to use a restroom, huh?
That's right, yeah, but, I tried to keep up, and when I'm off work, I'll drink 12 or 15 glasses of water
wow.
per day. So just a general trying to get my body in balance in general so that the calendula would have no reason to be there.
Hmm.
And, I thought it was all voodoo because, I'm one of these people that trusted in traditional medicine completely before this happened. But it's working.
So your lesions are diminishing?
Most of my lesions are gone. I don't know if Deborah showed you the pictures that I sent.
She did. And we're on radio. If you want to describe it a little bit, visual description will tell a lot of work. Will describe your situation.
Well, there was one picture there. Was July of 2003. I had lesions all over my legs up to the middle of my thighs. They were up to a quarter inch deep and up to a half an inch round. And I also had the not quite so big lesions on my arms and shoulders, which I didn't send you pictures of. So that, and then, so then it was around that time that I saw a Lyme doctor who's diagnosing a lot of people with Lyme here in the province that I live in, which I now call British Columbia.
Hmm.
And, he's diagnosed 400 or more people with Lyme, but a lot of them I've talked to have the same symptoms as me. But the antibiotics seem to help a bit, so that then, I don't know if you have the second picture there. That was from August of 2004. Did you have a second picture?
I think I did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In that one, the lesions were, I had just as many lesions, but they weren't deep anymore. They mm-hmm. were more on the surface of the skin.
Again, I'm making general statements, but the dermatology community's interest or lack of interest in patient care around a condition like this. Deborah, you have, I think, up to 2,000 people now who have registered on your on your site regarding this. What can be said about the limited amount of information on parasitology? And is there a subspecialty in dermatology that's at least a little more open and people should consider going to?
Well, I've always suggested that people seek forensic medical professionals mm-hmm. because they're one of the specialties that stayed intact through all the changes in medicine. They're there for what other people can't figure out. And funny enough, CSI on television, mm-hmm. the forensic show that's so popular, that's the word I was looking for. Their mantra is, listen to the evidence. And it so applies to this. When you get to see the data on all these people, it's just consistently the same. And I think that the dermatology mentality is one that's difficult to unentrench, if that's a word, and we need to find other specialists who will be more open-minded and fair to evaluating these people rather than thinking that a delusional diagnosis gives them the freedom to dismiss the people if they think they have a delusional illness other than medicating them. That still would warrant serious following and attention. So there's an irony there that's not too pretty.
Can one request a consultation with a forensic pathologist if one's alive?
I think they're difficult to find. I know all the police departments have them,
mm-hmm.
but they have huge associations that you probably could Google online. I would discourage people from running to the Lyme angle. I think that trying to fix something that you really don't have a sense of what it is the ultimate challenge. So if they could find their way to forensic specialists that could do the science that would visually document the reality for their skin, then you could go from there. But until that happens, it's a brick wall that people are bouncing off of everywhere.
David, when you went to the second dermatologist who wanted to also prescribe antipsychotic medications, and you spoke to your family medicine doctor, and thought you'd give it a try. You mentioned that you actually had induced psychosis from the medication. Were you also in treatment with a psychiatrist while you were medicated, or it was only recommended that you take the medication?
No, I wasn't in treatment with a psychiatrist or psychologist. That's what I found strange, was that a dermatologist is giving me medicine for a supposed mental disorder.
Yes. And when was there some suggestion that if you took this antipsychotic medication, it would be a period of a couple of weeks and it would all go away? Or was this suggested that for the rest of your life you would be on antipsychotic medication?
They suggested that it would take some time, at least anyway, before I would start to notice a difference. And probably it would have taken, in the, if I'd taken it for the time that they wanted me to take it, I'd probably be in a state where I wouldn't even notice that I was alive. Hmm. From the reaction I had from the ORAP, which, by the way, I've since found out contains a vermicide and an antiparasitic. But they didn't tell me that either.
Deborah, are many of the people registering also reporting that they've been prescribed antipsychotic medication?
Yes, I would think that's the hallmark of the mm-hmm. of the reports that we're getting.
And without any therapeutic relationship to follow them and monitor them?
No, not that we're aware of. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, everybody's practicing psychiatry without a license, basically. And, no, the people really don't want this population to visit their office.
Are there greater numbers of men to women or women to men who are suffering with this?
We have more reports from women, but I think that's more of a reporting mm-hmm. Factor than it is an incidence factor. We certainly hear from a considerable amount of men. They don't seem to be bogged down by it as much as women. They brush it off and deny, but you know, there are also questions. There's a lot of questions that we don't have answers to, but there are big questions about, are there people that are carrying this from person to person without being symptomatic versus those that suffer, as David has?
And any children?
Entire families, which is, you know, attributed by the dermatologists as what they call mass hysteria. So everyone is psychotic or delusional by proxy or something. I don't know how that works, but entire families. And families who had a guest in their home at the time of onset from a foreign country or they took in a stray cat or their house flooded or the sewage backed up or they crawled under the house to get a dead animal. You know, varieties like this that still come back to nature.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I am struck and deeply disturbed and moved by the testimony by you, David, and by the reporting by you, Deborah, and your fortitude and perseverance on behalf of community. So in the next 4 minutes, let's see where we can go in terms of either posing a question or if you have, in fact, Deborah, something you'd like to state before closing.
Well, I think that once a physician labels this, whatever they may label it, they have a choice, and that is to follow this person responsibly or to refer them to someone else. But a diagnosis of delusional illness carries great responsibility, just as a diagnosis of being infested with lice or scabies or calendula. So there's no easy way out of this, and there needs to be a sincere scientific collective effort to get to the bottom of it sooner rather than later, although it's been a long time since the calls first started coming in. So that's why we're here. We hope we'll have others contact us with more hopeful information following the program.
Will you please let people know how they can reach you?
Yes, the best way is our website, which is headlice.org. Our phone number is 781-449-6487, and there's an answering device there if the office staff isn't available during the night or whatever, whenever you feel like calling. But certainly register at headlice.org on the reporting registry if you are one of these individuals that have the biting and the crawling and the feeling that nobody believes you.
Mm. David, I want to thank you for joining us and give you a moment to also express your final comment.
What I can suggest is what I tell people that Deborah puts me in touch with is, if you go to a dermatologist and he won't do a skin scraping or denies that he knows how to do a skin scraping, denies that he has a microscope, then just walk out of his office. Don't talk to him anymore because he doesn't know how to do his job or he doesn't want to do his job, and you're wasting your time. And then you could probably also make a complaint to, if you have a college of physician or surgeons for your state, complain that this guy doesn't even know how to do his job. If they get enough complaints, maybe they'll take some action.
Thank you. I want to thank Deborah Altshuler from the National Pediculosis Association. Their website is www.headlice.org, where you can go online and get more information and also register if you are someone who feels as though you have a condition that has been similarly described today on today's program. David, for your courage to step forth, to share your personal story, we are forever grateful. I wish you continued healing and complete recovery, and your courage and your advocacy for yourself and others is quite admirable, and we appreciate you joining us today on WBAI.
Welcome, and thanks for doing this show.
Thank you, Barbara.
My pleasure. Thank you, Michael, for engineering today's program. I'm Barbara Glickstein. You're tuned in to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. You've been listening to Health Styles, which is brought to you by the Nursing and Health Resource Network in cooperation with the New York County Registered Nurses Association. Stay tuned. Continue to support this important radio program and this important radio station. Your money is needed. Your funding is needed. Help us by sending in a contribution. And take good care.